2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 251, The Reed Smoot Hearings and the Shaping of 20th Century Mormonism, a paper presented by Kathleen Flake.
Give you a chance to talk to me about why I made some of the choices I did. On the other hand, some of the arguments are kind of complicated, and I think you deserve to have a coherent presentation today. So I do have a paper here, and I'm going to read it. But let me contextualize it so that you will feel free to examine any of the other ideas that are raised in the book itself. I'm going to try to take no more than 35 to 40 minutes and leave you 20 to 25 minutes to talk to ask me questions about it. Of course, the book is nominally about the Reed Smoot hearings. Generally, the facts about those are they went from 1904 to 1907. That's a four-year proceeding in front of the Senate Committee on Privileges and Elections. The hearing was convened on the occasion of the election of a Mormon apostle, Reed Smoot, to the United States Senate, and the filing of a complaint by the Salt Lake Ministerial Association that was soon joined by all the major social reform associations in the United States. To give you a sense of the scope of the outcry, today it fills 11 feet of shelf space in the National Archives, the largest such collection in the archives. More than 3 million Americans signed petitions. Over 100 witnesses testified in the proceedings and created a record of 3,500 pages. And yes, I read it. What else can I tell you about it? I address the question. Well, my argument is that it was during the course of these hearings that the Mormon problem was finally solved for the nation, that it wasn't solved in 1890, and that's the historical question in the book. And I argue also that it was solved by compromise, not by accommodation. I learned this as a lawyer myself, that most of the serious problems, and you know this as a matter of common sense, the real problems don't go away until people get something of what they want. Otherwise, they just steal the children or pick up a gun or do something else, like keep practicing polygamy. You know, you just, until you get something you want more, you don't give up these things that mean so much to you generally in life. So I talk about the three parties to this hearing: the state in the form of the United States Senate, the Latter-day Saints, of course, and then the Protestant Reform Agencies. What was the settlement crafted in the context of a political trial that enabled each of these old antagonists to go home finally and to stop fighting as aggressively as they had been? You'll have to read the book for the answer, or if you want to ask me in the question and answer, I'll tell you the short answer to all of that. I want to rather go today to one of two theoretical questions that frame the study. The other theoretical question I won't be talking about, but I invite you to question me if you like, is what is required of a church or a religion in order to obtain religious citizenship, if you will, in order to receive the protections of the First Amendment? What does the nation require of a church in order to extend that kind of liberty? I think, I argue in this book, that it was in this period that the United States crafted a criteria for religious citizenship that has served us well throughout the 20th century, and that we may be in the process of having to recraft in the 21st. But it was on the occasion of having to deal once again with the Mormon problem, and this time the United States Senate as opposed to the Supreme Court, that the nation decided just what it was you had to do to get religious liberty in the United States. The other question I have, the theoretical question, is a religious studies one about how do religions change and retain their sense of identity as mediating the divine. And by that I mean all religions hold themselves out as providing for the faithful and experience of the divine, which is by definition unchanging, right? The old hymn, O thou who changest not, abide with me. That's one of the great distinctions between us and God. We change. That characterizes our whole existence. Now, religions, of course, must change too, or they die, like everything else in this life. If churches don't change, they're going to die. And I could list you some names of churches you won't recommend it because they died. And at the same time, if they do change, it shakes the faithful's confidence that they really do mediate the divine, that they represent God. Because God doesn't change, right? How come the church is changing? So you get into this kind of false crisis, I would say false crisis of faith. So the question is not, for me, the question properly phrased in a way that it illuminates the nature of religion is not, do religions change, much less ought they to change? It's when they change, how do the successful ones do it? How do they continue to adapt to their culture in a way that maintains their sense of who they are? And that's the aspect of the paper I'd like to the book I'd like to share with you today. Specifically, how did the Latter-day Saints adapt without losing their religion? And so let me just begin in December 1905, when the core of Latter-day Saint leadership departed Utah on two seemingly disparate missions to the East Coast. One contingent, led by the Senator Apostle Reed Smoot, went to defend the church in Senate hearings in Washington, D.C. Smoot was returning for the final stage of his four-year hearing on whether he could retain his seat. Ultimately, Smoot would prevail, but that's not our focus today. Rather, we will concentrate on the other contingent, led by Church President Joseph F. Smith, who went to Vermont to dedicate a monument to church founder Joseph Smith. My paper explores how these forays into national politics and religious memory refashioned the Latter-day Saints' own identity as well as public perception of them for the remainder of the 20th century. On December 18th, the representatives of the church's elite families embarked on a reverse trek from Salt Lake City to New England. In a rail car set aside for their use, they traveled to Vermont to dedicate a monument just built to mark the 100th anniversary of Joseph Smith's birth. Before returning to their headquarters behind the mountains, this aging second generation of church leaders and their mature children would travel 5,500 miles and visit the formative sites of their faith, preaching the LDS past and future at gatherings in the East and the Midwest. Like all commemorations, this celebratory journey involved not simply remembering but also forgetting, and that is true of all exercises in collective memory. The upshot of my presentation today is that when Church President Joseph F. Smith dedicated the monument to Joseph Smith, the nephew was not only honoring his uncle and founding prophet, Joseph Smith, the nephew was also in the difficult position of preparing the church for a transition away from, even a forgetting of, Joseph Smith's last revelatory initiative, namely plural marriage. In its place, President Smith would place renewed significance on Joseph Smith's first revelation, which established church belief in an embodied Godhead and the inauthenticity of Christian denominations. In short, Joseph F. Smith was creating a new and more socially tolerable source of otherness for his people, whose existing differences... That was a mistake, wasn't it? Whose existing differences with the rest of the country were threatening it with extinction. I'll put it back up. Maybe I'll like it better. In 1905, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was again in serious trouble with the United States government. The seat of war was an investigative hearing in the Senate to determine, and I've mentioned this, but Smoot was merely the opportune subject, not the object of the protesters' campaign. In briefs filed with the Senate, the protesters took care to stipulate, "We accuse him, Smoot, of no offense cognizable at law." Rather, they argued, Smoot's ineligibility for office was based on his participation in a religious cabal that violated the law, corrupted the home, and controlled Utah's government and economy at the expense of the nation. Similarly, the protest interests ran deeper than the rejection of Smoot from federal office. They hoped, in the words of one commentator, that, quote, the Smoot case will abolish Mormonism without war. The scandalous blemish will be wiped out by the irresistible abrasion of the public intelligence, judgment, conscience, and indignation. The nation had already tried and failed, and you know this story, to do this with warfare and criminal indictment in the 19th century. But this time they chose as their forum the Senate. Now, if somebody knows how to stop, can you hear this squealing? Down like that? Okay. Can you still hear? No, I'm hearing the opposite. Is this good right here? Can you hear? Okay. We'll stop again if this doesn't work and together solve this problem. This time, rather than the army and criminal statute, they had a political trial to try to experiment with solving the Mormon problem. And the truism is true that politics is the art of compromising. Neither the Latter-day Saints nor the Protestants entered the hearing expecting to compromise. Both put forward the most aggressive defense of their claims possible. In the end, however, a weakened Protestantism and a chastened Mormonism gave up some of what they wanted in order to get what they wanted most. Today, I'm going to limit my remarks to what Mormonism wanted, how they got it without losing their faith, and how it changed them for the remainder of the century. To answer the first question, what Mormonism wanted, I turn to Joseph F. Smith's inaugural sermon in 1901. This is the year before Smoot ran for office. President Smith began his address by telling his people what they already knew from experience. "We have," he said, "been looked upon as interlopers, as fanatics, as believers in a false religion. We have been regarded with contempt and treated despicably. We have been driven from our homes, maligned and spoken evil of everywhere, until the people of the world have come to believe that we are the offscourings of the earth and scarcely fit to live." Then he got closer to the core problem. "There are thousands and thousands of innocent people in the world whose minds have become so darkened by the slanderous reports that have gone forth concerning us that they would feel they were doing God's service to deprive a member of this church of life or of liberty or of pursuit of happiness if they could do it." End of quote. In short, things had gotten so bad that the church could not accomplish its God-given purpose, its very reason for being, unless it overcame its bad reputation. Now, the most obvious expression of the Latter-day Saints' purpose is the proselytizing program, which at the turn of the century was experiencing increasing difficulties with foreign governments and certain domestic ones. In the last two decades of the 19th century, violence against Latter-day Saints was not infrequent in the United States, including the burning of meeting houses, whipping and tar and feathering of missionaries, and the murder of as many as six missionaries and two church members. As late as 1902, one missionary caught organizing a Sunday school in Van Buren County, Arkansas, was tied to a tree, given 30 lashes, and promised worse if he returned. Attacks were reported in the church's international missions as well. Moreover, legal restraints were being applied to the church and its members. Domestic and foreign governments had denied or terminated visas of missionaries, refused to license the organization of congregations, and enjoined immigration. In 1903, the church's first presidency reported that, quote, "Mayor Lowe of New York has withdrawn all permits from our elders to preach in the streets of that city. The banishment of our brethren from Germany is another phase of this same widespread effort. While at home and abroad, scurrilous lying tracts and pamphlets are being distributed far and wide in the effort to create a public opinion actively hostile to the church and its teachings." For the Latter-day Saints, this was an ontological crisis. It was not merely a problem of church growth. As the prophesied ensign to the nations, or the harbinger of the millennial reign, the church's primary purpose was to prepare the world for the second coming of Christ by preaching its restored gospel. Seen in this light, the ultimate harm caused by the church's bad reputation was the extent to which it prevented the church from accomplishing the purpose for which it had been organized. Smith closed his sermon with a promise, even a prophecy. "The Lord designs to change this condition of things and to make us known to the world in our true light as true worshipers of God." In the years that followed, this conviction no doubt guided certain of his decisions that were least popular within the church, especially his decision to reverse himself and support Smoot's candidacy for a Senate seat and to sacrifice the practice of plural marriage. To one of his brethren who disagreed, he said, quote, in the most forceful and positive manner, "If ever the Spirit of the Lord was manifested to men, anything clear and plain and positive, it is this, that Reed Smoot should remain in the United States Senate," end of quote. As far as Smith was concerned, Smoot was in the Senate for the church's benefit, and God would ensure that he stayed there. For the first time in its 55-year battle with the federal government, the church had something to gain besides survival. And that's really important. The church had something to gain besides survival. The church put on the... Consequently, during the Smoot hearings, the church put on the negotiating table for the first time that nemesis of Protestant morality and threat to American democracy, polygamy. The Smoot hearing required compromise from all parties. The church's contribution to reaching a solution was, for reasons too complex to describe here, but again, in question and answer, if you want me to talk about it, I will, the dismissal of two of its apostles, John W. Taylor and Matthias F. Cowley, from the quorum. This was the first disciplinary action ever taken by the LDS Church against any member, much less its hierarchy, for the practice of plural marriage. Taylor and Cowley's release from the Quorum of the Twelve for being, quote, out of harmony, end of quote, with their brethren was an extraordinary, as well as necessarily, public about-face on a core doctrine of faith. By striking down two of their most popular and powerful leaders, the Church eventually satisfied the Senate. More immediately, however, this dramatic action made it clear to the rank-and-file saints that the Church was abandoning its commitment to plural marriage, and therefore immediate attention had to be given to shoring up the faith of those who had staked so much on the principle. While Joseph F. Smith's ultimate goal in sending Smoot to the Senate was, quote, to make us assume our real position and standing in the midst of the earth, Smith first had to ensure that the changes precipitated by the hearing did not knock the church off its feet. Modern Mormonism's capacity to adapt to its social environment has been explained in terms of its belief in continuing revelation and a lack of theological depth. Such interpretations, however, do not do justice to the complexity of belief in revelation and more especially of the LDS theology of revelation. Belief in revelation is not of itself sufficient to legitimize change, if only because the conflict inherent in undoing a past revelation, even with a present one. Removing a part of religious conviction can easily remove the whole of it. This is especially true where the part is thoroughly integrated into the whole, as was plural marriage for the Latter-day Saints. Now, I'm going to summarize these three parts because I'm hoping you have some sense of why polygamy mattered in the 19th century, but let me just summarize it under three elements. One is, obviously, it was associated with the prophet Joseph Smith, and when it was reintroduced to the church in 1852, it was reintroduced as the last revelatory initiative of the prophet, and it had that sense of attachment to it. To be true to the prophet meant practicing polygamy, particularly in light of the RLDS, later the RLDS identification of itself in opposition to the principle. So therefore, being a true follower of Joseph Smith meant embracing the principle. Okay? Secondly, in the course of fighting with the United States government on First Amendment grounds, the church was required to phrase its defense of polygamy in particular ways that would be recognized by the United States government. And so it's during this period that you have Section 132 included in the Doctrine and Covenants. You have them ratifying ratifying legal documents saying that it is a central belief of the church, because in order to qualify for First Amendment protections, it had to be a central belief. And so you see a buildup of this language about the centrality of it, in addition to the fact of Joseph Smith's legacy. And I think the one that's most difficult for us to discuss today, and I think there are many here who would disagree with me on this, and that was the theological integrity of polygamy in light of other Mormon doctrines of priesthood and consecration. And I think I'll just state this as my own conclusion again, that you cannot understand the continuing practice of polygamy by the brethren unless you understood that they saw it as a fullness of the priesthood. And you could not You could not represent the church in those quorums without the fullness of the priesthood. But I'll save that lecture for Sunday school. And I will move on and just simply say this was an incredibly important piece of revelation that they were going to have to abandon. But let me begin, pick up again here at just the last little summary paragraph with an amusing quotation from President Smith on the witness stand. Because plural marriage constituted for the saints an order of the priesthood, not to practice it was to lack a form of priesthood authority or certain mediating rights prerequisite to leading the congregation of the church. This meant that plural marriage was a necessary condition of LDS leadership position and priestly power. When Senator Hoar observed to Joseph F. Smith, and Senator Hoar was the senator from Massachusetts and a leading, if not the leading, constitutional lawyer in the country, he said to Joseph F. Smith on the witness stand, "Now, the New Testament apostle says that a bishop must be sober and must be the husband of one wife." And Smith retorted, "At least." Now, Senator Hoar may have been amused, and certain people in the hearing room did laugh, but Smith could not have been amused. His task was formidable. He had to remove his people's faith in one revelation without undermining their confidence in all revelation, as well as the revelator, namely Joseph Smith, and himself as Smith's successor. This required reshaping the saints' history, their canon, and their ecclesiology. So all three categories of plural marriage's integration with the church's self-understanding as a matter of history and canon and design of the church had to be unraveled. Now, the manifesto began, as you know, as a press release, and only after pressure from the government tribunals was it put into the entire church for adoption and expanded in scope. The effect of the manifesto had always been compromised by the widespread assumption that it was a political expediency, to which members were not accountable except politically. Thus, while the church had been drawn along the path to abandoning celestial marriage since the manifesto in 1890, the dismissal in 1905 of two apostles for their practice of polygamy intensified, to a heretofore unknown degree, the need to obtain the saints' confidence in church leadership. Conveniently, 1905 was also the centennial anniversary of the birth of the prophet whose status was in crisis. The dedication that same year of a monument to Joseph Smith provided the occasion for identifying what about him and his legacy mattered to the church and what would be carried forward into the 20th century to provide it with continuing confidence in both the original prophet and his 20th century successors. So you have to remember, Joseph F. Smith's own legitimacy with the church was also on the line during these years, and it was hotly contested. On December 18th, only days after making the decision to sacrifice Taylor and Cowley, and with three other members of his apostolic quorum in hiding on similar allegations, namely George Teasdale, Heber J. Grant, and Mariner W. Merrill, President Smith gathered what was left of his administration and boarded the train to go dedicate the Joseph Smith Monument in Vermont. Having done what he could to ensure the church's institutional future by sacrificing the two apostles, Joseph F. Smith now had to reconstitute its religious past. He had to remove his people's faith in one revelation without undermining all of revelation. It was serendipitous that the centennial of Smith's birthday came at a time when the faithful needed something to celebrate, and needed to celebrate Joseph Smith in particular. And, of course, this is another kind of common sense conclusion, but it's a very powerful one. Memorialization of a birth is the blankest of slates upon which to write history. Right? Thus, the centennial of Joseph Smith's birth was ideally suited to his nephew's task, namely redefining the central tenets in the saints' claims about their founding prophet and his church, while simultaneously accentuating their continuity with the past, something we may want to listen for in 2004. Leaving overt historicizing to others during the ceremonies, Joseph F. Smith spoke only to dedicate the monument, and his prayer stipulated the elements of his uncle's mission, which would be carried forward into the 20th century as inviolable, even to the consciousness of change. Thanking God For the great prophet and seer of the 19th century, Joseph F., made an offering of each element of the monument in terms of its symbolic significance. First, the monument's huge cement foundation symbolized the primitive church, or in Joseph F. Smith's words, quote, "The foundation thou hast laid of prophets and apostles with Jesus Christ, thy Son, as the chief cornerstone." End of quote. Secondly, upon this foundation was laid a 4-foot-thick, 30-ton granite base, quote, "typifying the rock of revelation," end of quote. And finally, erected on the base of prophets and apostles and the rock of revelation was a 38.5-foot shaft of granite representing a foot for every year of Joseph Smith's life, representing the, quote, "perfect man." Perfect man. The shaft was polished to symbolize Smith's, quote, "reflecting the light of heaven," end of quote. At its pinnacle, the shaft was crowned to illustrate Smith's successful completion of his mission and the possibility for all to be similarly glorified. These three elements, and they should be so familiar to you that you're unconscious of them, and that's what they're intended to be: a foundational restoration of Christ's church from apostasy, a base of continuing revelation from heaven, and an assertion of Joseph Smith's revelatory power and divine authority bestowed to those that follow. These are the core elements of LDS doctrine, and today frame the church's self-identity within America's religious pluralism. And it is the message the dedicatory party preached on their way home. So they go to Vermont, they dedicate the monument, and they begin to preach sermons on their way home at different centers. Now, I'm going to skip this part, too, and simply observe that part of the analysis of this book goes to where they chose to stop and where they chose not to stop on this trip back home. And the upshot is that they stopped in Kirtland. Well, they stopped at, of course, Palmyra, Kirtland, and then they went to Chicago, and they skipped Nauvoo. Even though the train goes right through Omaha, they don't go to Council Bluffs. They don't stop at any of the sources. Let me just read this paragraph. In geographic terms, this meant that the party did not visit Independence near Kansas City, Missouri, the site of their first attempt to build an American Zion. Neither did they stop in Nauvoo. Both of these places have powerful associations with later developments in LDS doctrine. For example, polygamy was first practiced in Nauvoo, as were the nascent forms of theocratic government, which would find full expression in Utah. Similarly, the anti-capitalist principles that had characterized Utah's economy were first practiced in Missouri. Finally, the temple ceremonies and oaths of such concern. The Senate here. What? Sorry. Similarly, the anti-capitalist principles that had characterized Utah's economy were first practiced in Missouri. Finally, the temple... Oh, I should tell you what that was about. Did you hear what that was about? They can't hear me on the tape. So, I didn't want you all wondering that. But you see, those people aren't here, and you are. And that's the benefit you have. Finally, the temple ceremony and oaths of such concern to the Senate hearing panel were performed first in Nauvoo. In sum, those practices that had placed the church in conflict with American institutions were largely a byproduct of the saints' history in Missouri and Illinois, and to these sites the dedicatory party did not go. And then I go and talk about it a little bit more. And in this respect, by avoiding these certain places, they illustrate another means by which Mormonism transformed itself during this period. Their message to member and non-member became indistinguishable. Instead of being admonished to do the works of Patriarch Abraham and aspire to deification, the saints were encouraged to manifest Yankee virtues and moral rectitude. Exhortations to do missionary work overtook the other elements of 19th century millennialism. Growth not gathering to Zion became the rallying cry, though in fairness to the doctrinal significance remains the same, only obscured. During Joseph F. Smith's tenure, immigration to Utah was officially ended, and the church began to build centers of membership abroad. Plural or temple marriage, as it is now called, was redefined in terms of the timelessness, not the multiplicity, of marriage partnership. The more exotic doctrines from the Missouri and Illinois periods of Smith's work remained in LDS temples and thus privately practiced. Whatever gap may have been created by defining plural marriage as temple marriage, gathering as growth, and deification as moral perfection, was bridged by the classic restorationist's claims monumentalized in Sharon, Vermont, a foundational restoration of Christ's church from apostasy, a base of continuing revelation from heaven, and a capstone in Joseph Smith's revelatory power and divine authority bestowed on those that follow. Like the itinerary of the dedicatory trip, the Mormonism lived publicly in the 20th century consisted of the doctrines taught in the first years of Smith's life and preached in New York and Ohio. Given the scope of these changes, however, more than Vermont granite was needed to shore up the saint's foundational belief. Inscribed on the monument's northerly side was a reference to Smith's first vision in 1820, when he was instructed by divine personages to reject all existing churches. Other surfaces on the monument were devoted to Smith's subsequent experiences of angelic restoration of knowledge and authority to organize the Church of Jesus Christ in its fullness and perfection. And that's a quote. Historians of this period have noted the new significance given to Joseph Smith's narrative of his initial experiences with the divine. Largely ignored in the 19th century, Joseph Smith's first vision was first used in Sunday school texts in 1905 and priesthood instructional manuals in 1909, as a separate missionary tract in 1910, and in histories of the church in 1912. Eventually it, not the Book of Mormon, was granted the status of, quote, the beginning point, the fountainhead of the church's restoration, end of quote. In Joseph Smith's first vision, Joseph F. Smith found a marker of LDS identity whose pedigree was as great and would be made greater than that of plural marriage for 20th century saints. The first vision contained all the elements necessary to fulfill the historical, scriptural, and theological void created by the abandonment of plural marriage. To the extent that plural marriage had captured the saints' loyalty as Smith's last revelation, the first revelation, as its referent indicates, was equally appealing. It also, like polygamy, was both an historical event and an idea that could be characterized as attracting persecution. 19th century saints had not endeared themselves to their neighbors by claiming to be the only true church in a religiously plural society. New emphasis on the first vision served to maintain a sense of religious difference, and as such provided the equally necessary sense of internal cohesiveness and historical continuity in terms of persecution. Significantly, however, the new emphasis on the first vision changed the arena of confrontation from social behavior to theological belief, from behavior to belief, a necessity created not only by the experience of persecution, but by Supreme Court law. In its 1878 Reynolds decision, the Supreme Court announced that American government would tolerate only differences in religious thought, not religious actions, which compete with social mores. New emphasis on the first vision successfully reframed the saints' necessary sense of otherness so that it fits safely within the politics of American religion. Jan Shipps, however, had rightly warned students of Mormonism, and I would add believers of Mormonism, that, quote, when Mormon history begins with the first vision, the result tends to be an account of a religious movement which, even as it differs dramatically on basic theological and doctrinal issues from other sects and churches, is analytically yet one more subdivision of Christianity inaugurated through the efforts of a charismatic leader, end of quote. That is, however, exactly what the Senate panel was asking the church to become. Yet one more subdivision of Christianity inaugurated through the efforts of a charismatic leader. That's exactly what the government needed the Mormons to become. Unlike Joseph Smith's last vision, his first one placed his followers at odds only with other churches, not the state, and shifted the battle from issues of public morality to theological tenets. David Thielen describes accurately the task undertaken by the saints at the start of this now completed 20th century. Quote, he says, people develop a shared identity by identifying, exploring, and agreeing on memories. In the course of taking a picture or creating an album, They decide what they want to remember and how they want to remember it, end of quote. Right? You know this. You've done this. You kind of put that one picture away in the back until you can bring yourself to throw it away, but you are choosing what to forget as well as what to remember when you come up with those family scrapbooks. Beginning in 1905, with the monument at Smith's birthplace, Joseph F. Smith set about turning the American landscape into the saint's scrapbook. Integrating LDS history into the American terrain and directing his people's attention beyond the Rocky Mountains to where he believed their future lay. He would be so successful that eventually they would hardly be aware that they were agreeing to forget, and if made aware, would tend to think they were forgetting Brigham Young. In fact, they were in the process of forgetting portions of Smith's legacy, which Young had taken so literally. In place of its 19th century theocratic and familial kingdom building, the church was prepared by crisis to return to less grandiose but still large claims regarding restoration of the primitive church, divine sponsorship, and living prophets. These principles constituted for 20th century saints the generative and hence non-negotiable core of Mormonism. They were carved in stone, both literally on the surface of the Joseph Smith Monument and figuratively in terms of the church's identity. Armed with an adapted narrative of their past and pilgrimage sites illustrating this narrative, the Latter-day Saints have been able to retain their identity even as they changed radically. In this, they are not unique, but they are instructive of the means by which communities of faith maintain, amidst change, a sense of continuity and integrity with their originating vision of the eternal. In short, the LDS Church's successful transition into the 20th century reveals the generative and regenerative powers of narrative and ritual for the religious communities that succeed in outliving the times that bore them. Okay, thank you. Now, would anybody like to ask questions about anything that I've talked about? Yes.
How much of this change do you think was conscious on the part of Joseph F. Smith, and how much was just sort of happened?
So the question is, how much of this was conscious, and how much of it just happened? I think that there's no way to know that. How I handle it in the book is I say, since there's no way to know it directly, my own hypothesis is that this man was such a product of the church. And those of you who don't know his history, I recommend that you read it. It's an extraordinary history that is inseparable from the history of the church. Born in 1839, this man was there at every bad happening ever for the next, almost 70 years. But he learned, that's like asking how some people ride so easily. It's because they were born in the saddle. I think he was born in the saddle. And that he was instinctively responding to the needs of the church. Now, the faithful would say, reasonably, within the logic of the faith, that this was revelation. And Joseph F. Smith himself claimed that one of the strongest, if not the strongest revelation anybody ever received in the church was the revelation he got that Smith should stay in the Senate. And believe me, there were the majority of the apostles who did not agree with him. And so, as a prophet, it is legitimate for those who take him as a prophet to say he was acting prophetically when he made these changes. Even acting prophetically, though, from what we know about prophets, I don't think they can anticipate the ramifications of the decisions they make, even under revelation. Why don't I just come down and see if that works? Well, I don't know if I can jump down there. Will it go down here? Well, that was an admission of my age, wasn't it? Okay. Is this, in fact, if I come all the way down here? Can you help me with this? Okay. Thank you very much. So the answer is we can't know. As a scholar, I say this was intuitive. He was born in the saddle and he knew how to ride this horse in a way that nobody else did of his generation. And as a Latter-day Saint, I would say God was revealing to him, but still, it was a rough ride. I don't think he had any idea what he was going to have to do before, you know, the day was over, including, I think it was just personally horrifying to him to ask those two apostles to fall on their swords. Yes. For the practice of polygamy. And what I'm trying to emphasize there is you look at the amount of pressure the church was under for those more than 50 years. And whatever else they did, they never disciplined a single member until 1905, and they canned two apostles. I mean, that's just extraordinary.
For polygamy.
For polygamy, absolutely. I mean, people were having trouble on a number of occasions on other matters. No.
In your speech, you said
they shifted the embassy from the multiplicity of wives to the eternity of the relationship.
So, did they not teach the eternity of the relationship? Or they
taught the eternity of the relationship. That was assumed. But and people, this you can reasonably debate this proposition. That's why I said what I did when I was giving the. My truncated paper there, that there are people who can legitimately argue that plural marriage was always a matter of the length of the relationship, not the number of the spouses in the union. I think certainly in the Valley you would find the emphasis being on the number of marriage partners, and in fact people Joseph F. Smith is reported in the Journal of Discourses is saying that people who did not embrace polygamy, you know, were violating the law of the church and wouldn't be exalted. So they were pretty clear about that, but it was number in those days. Yes, Kim?
Just to clarify, I think that the word eternal is translated eternus, which means eternal.
Well, I was avoiding the Sunday school lesson, but that is true. In D&C 64, it does say, when he's talking about punishment, that eternal it's eternal punishment, but lest you misunderstand me, I don't mean it goes on forever. It's eternal punishment because it's my punishment. So now I'll give you the sermon. The sermon is that next time you're at a wedding, and they talk about eternal marriage in terms of time, you say no. It is eternal marriage because it's God's marriage. It has the characteristics of God. That's what we seek through these unions. It's like Bob's marriage or Helen's marriage. It's God's marriage. You know, it's eternal marriage. That's an attribute of godliness. It's not an attribute of time. But thank you, Kim. So there's your Sunday school lesson. I don't think they made it to be temporal. Right.
Did the leading brethren have to change their domestic patterns during the time of this Reed Smoot trial in order to improve the appearance or the image of polygamy versus monogamy and so on?
No, those domestic patterns were in place and had been for many years. They, in the sense that they, the degree of circumspection did not change during the Smoot hearings. However, there is, I thought, a very funny story about Heber J. Grant. He's just back from Japan on his mission. He's set to go be head of the European mission. And as some of you may know, he only had daughters. Oh, speaker, thank you. He only had daughters. Oh, well. And I've got too many speakers. He only had daughters and he wanted a son. But the story is the U of U was having a fundraiser and he gave them $150. $50 for himself and each of his wives. Now this was right on the eve of Smoot having to file his answer with the United States Senate. And the papers around the nation, and even Teddy Roosevelt hauled Smoot into his office and said, "What the hell is going on out there?" You know, and Evie was on the midnight train to London. They didn't create the mission for him, but he left a little early. So yes, certain things had to change, but largely, I don't think it affected their domestic relationships, frankly. In fact, one of the more interesting things about this was the number of apostles. At least three apostles appear to have taken wives after 1901 or after, and in the middle of these proceedings. So that is a gives you some idea of how divided, in fact, divided isn't even the word, how you had Smoot and Lyman on one side and the rest of the quorum on the other on this issue. So no, they didn't change their domestic patterns that I was aware of. They had already done that through those years of criminal statutes and adjusting to the raids and all that. If anything, it was a little easier by 1901. Other questions?
Mike Quinn has documented about 7 or 8 plural marriages that occurred after the Little Manifesto of 1904. And, of course, it was after 1904 that Francis Lyman embarked on this crusade, almost, to go after these new marriages, quote-unquote, namely those performed after the Little Manifesto. Do you have any comments about this cognitive, or maybe, I guess it's cognitive dissonance between Francis Lyman and Joseph F. Smith, with Francis Lyman going hard down one path and Joseph F. Smith secretly performing still some additional plural marriages?
I look at that situation differently. I don't know that what I talk about in the book is the logistical difficulties in controlling polygamy. We tend to assume that, like Yul Brynner in the Ten Commandments, that when the brethren speak, it happens, you know. And I think one of the problems they had, even if they'd wanted to stop polygamy, they couldn't turn this ship on a dime. For too many years, they had been speaking in code for too many years, and they had dispensed the authority to perform these marriages too broadly. So at first they had to convince people that, no, really, we mean it this time. We mean it this time. So the question becomes, when did they mean it? In my book, I don't believe he meant it in 1904. And I don't think Joseph Smith meant anything more in 1904 than Wilford Woodruff meant in 1890. That he was still trying to rescue this doctrine. And think of it in this terms, those of you who, again, have trouble putting yourself in their shoes or thinking historically. This is not thinking faithfully, this is thinking historically. Imagine if, for whatever reason, the government came out and said you couldn't baptize anymore. What would you do?
Go underground.
It's obvious what you would do, right? Those who have swimming pools, you're all set. The rest of you would have to dig a font in your basement. But you'd do it. So that's kind of I think that's how I understand Joseph F. Smith and the quorum at that time about this doctrine. Then the question becomes, once they decide they're going to have to take the poison pill, and words aren't enough, nobody really believes them when they say, we're going to stop now. Really, we mean it this time. Really, we do. They don't believe him. So they have to come up with something to signal that they will subordinate themselves to the United States government. And that's what it amounts to. You have the old argument, time is short, I won't go into that. But then they have to do it, and arguably, at least if you look at Smoot's diaries, and the first one that you really can, we don't have the diary during this period, but in 1909, again, this is 2 years after he has been seated, right? In 1909, he's writing in his journal in frustration that the quorum is still supporting new plural marriages, and he's catching hell back in Washington from the Protestant reformers. And that there's still a move afoot for an amendment to the Constitution, and if the brethren don't do something, he can't make any guarantees to them what's going to happen. And so he talks about his meetings with the quorum on trying to get them to do something, and then he does what I think is he backdoors the quorum and he goes to Joseph F. and says, this is serious. You got to do something. Okay, so Joseph F. says, all right, okay, I believe we got to do something. Then the question becomes, what do we do? At what point how do we send the signal that communicates the issue? And how do we do it in a manner we consider just? And so they say, all right, we won't hold anybody accountable prior to 1904. So they set the date at 1904. And they say it will go after those who are in positions of authority, right? So these are stake presidents and patriarchs who have performed these recently, notwithstanding the fact that we have sent Francis M. Lyman around personally to say, no, we really mean it this time. So rather than seeing Francis M. Lyman on a tear, running around destabilizing things, I rather think that he was going around saying, look, we mean it this time, and if you don't stop it, we're going to have some very high-profile excommunications to make sure everybody knows we mean it this time. We have to stop. And the issue is not polygamy now. The issue is, do you accept Joseph F. Smith as a prophet, seer, and revelator? Will you accept his position as divinely inspired to cease the practice of polygamy? And if you don't, you're not excommunicated for your polygamy, you're excommunicated for what? Okay, so I don't do a whole lot with that period, but I don't think Francis M. Lyman was acting in any way. Now, did Joseph F. Smith perform marriages? I don't have evidence of that, but I didn't do that kind of research. Would I be surprised if he did? No, I wouldn't. Does it bother me that he did? No, obviously it doesn't. But, you know, I was a lawyer, so it takes a lot to bother me about the law.
You mentioned that part of your interest was how organizations change to survive the time.
Mm-hmm. The question is, will we remove Section 132? That invites speculation on my part. I don't think there's any need to remove it. Is anybody agitating about it in the church today? Would it change anything about how we understand polygamy to remove it? You know? I mean, yes. So I would be surprised. I'm much more inclined to think that you'll see the proclamation on the family move into the DNC rather than 132 move out of it.
Well, the fundamentalist
polygamists
in the West give the church so much
flat, Sure, but remember, our argument is intellectually coherent, which is we did not reject the practice of polygamy except as required by the United States government. But we believe through prophetic leadership we ceased the practice. And so there's no need to renunciate the doctrine. We've simply ceased the practice under modern revelation. But all these other things come in to shore up that decision is what I'm arguing. I think the fellow in the back had the first question and then... why wasn't the Second Manifesto canonized? Again, speculation. Motives are really hard to know in history. My guess is it was something that Joseph F. Smith didn't want to do, much less want to have canonized. Right? What motivated the Second Manifesto was he had to do something to tell the Senate that he meant it this time, right? He'd just come back from testifying in the Senate, and he told them what he testified. And then so he issued the Second Manifesto, but the underpinnings of that, if you read the context, had to do with sending the word out that the other brethren who were performing these marriages were to be careful not to make the prophet a liar in virtue of his testimony in Washington. So the Second Manifesto was to display the integrity of his testimony, however you want to define the integrity of that, and didn't have so much to do with polygamy as the audience for the Second Manifesto was not the church, in other words. It was the Senate. And so why would you canonize that? Right? Yeah.
If things might go with the way the church would change relative to if the United States government decides to make abortion legal again, you know, because of the recent court cases involving sodomy and other kinds of arguments that are being heard before the courts currently.
Mm-hmm. You know, you hear arguments on both sides of that. What is going to happen with as United States law recognizes increasingly diverse or restrains itself from actually believing that it is its job to recognize the legitimacy of sexual expression and enlarges the scope of relationships it acknowledges as legitimate. What's going to happen to polygamy? Will it be brought back? I don't know. When I think about it, the
if it were to be brought back on the federal side, how do you think the church would respond?
Oh, it wouldn't be. If there were a case that struck down anti-polygamy laws, then they would probably. I don't know. I would imagine you'd have to go around like you do with same-sex unions now, where you're using state constitutional laws. So you're going to have to see that battery of things. I don't know how the law is going to do it. If the church were ever in a position where it had to decide what to do about polygamy, I don't know how it would answer. I only have an appreciation for the complexity that goes like this. On the one hand, you could say the church would say, well, those who want to observe it can. And those who don't have to. And I think that's what everybody's kind of expecting. I think there's a doctrinal problem with that. You can't have... I think that's an invitation for schism. Because you have too much of a history, including Section 132 and Section 131, that were historically construed, anyway, to mean that polygamy was the higher law. And it was the fullness of the priesthood. It's that other point in my paper. So you can't have a church in Nigeria that's living the fullness of the priesthood and the folks down in Leighton not living it. Right? So we all go together where we go. But maybe they're going to find a way for us to go separately. But that in Mormonism, I think we all go together where we go. And my watch is on the stand. I don't know what time it is. Thank you. So, historical questions, anyone? Oh, thank you.
In your opinion, why do you think the church was so set on having Reed Smoot?
Why was the church so set on having Reed Smoot in the Congress? Good question. My answer comes out of that inaugural sermon where President Smith says, you know, we can't do our missionary work anymore. And if you can't do that in the Mormon church, you might as well close up shop. Again, this is the ensign to the nations. All this other stuff is fine, but our job here is to bear witness of the restoration for the second coming of Christ. And if you can't do that, well, we're in real trouble. So, I think, and I'm not, this is another question where how much did they foresee this? Did they see what the boon would be to having a senator? I don't know, but they certainly got that boon. Meaning, they sent. You got to remember the size of the Senate during this time, how politics were moving west, the amount of authority Smoot got very quickly, and he rose fast. But by 1923, this is the epilogue to the book. As chairman of Senate Finance, holding the purse strings of Congress, and a member of the War Reparations Board, deciding who gets what in Europe to rebuild after World War I, Senator Smoot. Okay, big guy, counselor to President Harding, probably the biggest dog in the Republican Party, gets invited to go on the ship Leviathan to Europe. It's a maiden voyage of a refitted ship. His wife can't go with him. So he says to President Grant, he says, well, now's the time to do that trip, I think, that we've been talking about. And he takes John A. Witzo as his junior companion, and they get on board this boat and they go to London, and he visits the heads of the governments in Northern Europe and says to them, why are you doing this to my church? And they stop. And it's an amazing act. The newspapers in Europe, he's such an important person that it's the only positive press the church has probably had in a half century, and certainly in the last 20 years by the time he gets there. He's able to talk to, the U.S. ambassadors fall all over themselves asking what they can do for him. And gosh, if we'd known you were having this trouble for your church, we would have helped you. Let us know what we can do for you. And things begin to change in the European missions. And now the Protestants were always concerned that the Mormons having a seat in the Senate would lead to kind of theocratic, anti-democratic influences. And that, of course, that never happened. But what did happen is the church very skillfully used his authority to follow the flag around the world and to establish its missions internationally. Remember what I said about the church stops its gathering under Joseph F. Smith and begins to build its stakes abroad and to build those missions. And my own sense is that all the initiatives that we tend to give David O. McKay credit for really are Joseph F. Smith's initiatives. In fact, David O. McKay was one of the replacement apostles for the three positions that were filled in the spring of 1906. Taylor, Cowley, and then Mariner W. Merrill passes away. And David O. McKay is brought in as one of the three new monogamous apostles. So all that internationalization, I think, the vision for it comes out of Joseph F. Smith's years, and the kickstart happens only because Smoot is in the Senate and is able to use American political authority to protect the church abroad. Thank you very much.